Hey, Bomb Squad. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, the podcast that's all about women and food. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, coming to you from my apartment in Brooklyn, New York. It's rare that a cake artist can claim a certain style all her own, but that's the case when it comes to the Milk Moon Kitchen Cakes by Azara Golston. Slice into one, if you dare, and it's a festival of layers, geometric shapes, and bright colors. When you see one of her Milk Moon Kitchen Cakes, the first question that comes to mind is, how does she do it? Well, Azara is here to tell us how. She also confirms that she is the creator of the Fault Line Cake. I know, I'm getting into cake nerd territory here, but you've probably seen Fault Line Cakes on Instagram, and if you're like me, at some point, you wondered where the trend began. Azara has had a lot of ups and downs this year, like so many of us. She landed a dream job at a lovely custom cake shop here in Brooklyn and sadly lost the job because of COVID. But she also recently became a new mom to a beautiful baby boy. Azara is a unique talent, and I was so thrilled to interview her. I have a feeling we're going to be hearing and seeing a lot more from Azara Golston in the months and years ahead. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting today's show. I'm always happy when I see that block of Kerrygold butter in my fridge. Some housekeeping. Cherry Bomb launched a special IG Live miniseries last week as part of Hispanic Heritage Month. It's Radio Cereza Bomba, and it's hosted by our friend Vera Rios, who is a Peruvian anthropologist studying toward her MA in food studies at NYU. The show happens to be our very first Spanish language program, and you can catch it on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. EST on IG Live. Vera has some terrific guests lined up, and if you miss the show, you can catch it later on IGTV. Before we get to Azara, here's a word from Kerrygold.
Kerrygold is delicious, all-natural butter and cheese, made with milk from Irish grass-fed cows. Our farming families pass their craft and knowledge from generation to generation.
I'm fifth generation. It goes back over 250 years.
This traditional approach is the reason for the rich taste of Kerrygold. Enjoy delicious new sliced or shredded Kerrygold cheddar cheese. Available in mild or savoury flavours at a retailer near you. Find your nearest store at KerrygoldUSA.com.
Now for my chat with Azara Golston of Milk Moon Kitchen. Azara, you've been baking and decorating cakes since you were 13 years old. I'd love to know how your interest in that began.
I had and continue to have a pretty wicked sweet tooth ever since I was a really little kid. And so I was always in the kitchen with my mom when she was baking, or with my Omi, my paternal grandmother, when she was baking. And, you know, eventually I just got to the point where my mom finally relented and allowed me to start making things like chocolate chip cookies on my own when I was pretty young, probably around like 8 or 9. And I got bitten by the baking bug, which happens to so many of us. Then eventually I was in high school and a friend of mine really loved to cook. And so we got together and we decided to make dinner for our families. And we got really ambitious and decided that we were going to do a bûche de Noël for dessert. For some reason, it wasn't Christmas. You know, it was really terrible. I'm pretty sure the cake itself, like, it cracked when we tried to roll it, and we had no idea what we were doing with, like, the buttercream. It was awful. It was really ugly. But I got very excited about this idea of using cake as a way to create art and sort of like express yourself. And so I was like, this is interesting. There's so much attention being paid to presentation, what it looks like. And so I started checking out the cake decorating books at the library, started saving up my allowances and asking for cookbooks for my birthdays. Pretty early on, I came across Margaret Brown's book, Cakewalk, and it completely blew my mind. She is an incredible artist. You probably immediately recognize her style because it's often imitated, but she was an art historian and she started doing cake decorating, and there's so much of that influence of art history and architecture in her work. And I just found it like very cool that someone was taking such a unique and like just interesting and personal approach to cake decorating. And so from there, I was just all in and have been cake decorating either on the side as a hobby kind of thing or professionally since then.
That's amazing. I don't think I knew what a bûche de Noël was until I was, I don't know, in my 30s. The fact that you're a teenager experimenting with that as your first cake is pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, it didn't go great, but it did start a thing for me.
What was your first paid gig as a baker?
So my first proper gig was actually an internship that I had in my junior year of high school, where I had the opportunity to work in a pastry kitchen, which was really cool. But the first time I got paid was later on that year. I started making cakes and other kind of like treats and little bites and stuff for my friends' parents when they were throwing parties. I ended up in my junior and senior years doing that. And, you know, sort of word got out and people started coming to me when they wanted to have like a birthday cake, or they were, you know, looking for a little sort of pastry hors d'oeuvre type things for like an evening party they were having. And that was super fun.
So we'll talk more about your career and professional trajectory later in the show. But I really want to get into the nitty gritty of how you make these cakes, because you can barely believe what you see. When you look at Instagram and you see these cakes, you're just like, how in the world did she make those? And then you go to your YouTube channel and watch the videos, and I'm still blown away. Like, your skill with those paring knives, the way you use cake as a material, like you push and prod it and bend it. These layers of cake are like Play-Doh.
A lot of it is just about the recipes that I've been slowly developing over the years. I started out on this path when I got really into making very, very fine layers in my cakes, because my cake decorating interest was one side of my kind of culinary world, but the other side was an interest in pastry and like fine pastry. And there are so many like gâteaux that have those very, very fine layers. And normally what you'd do is you would bake a sheet pan of cake and then use a circular cutter to punch out your cake layers. But I got really into, for some reason, baking up like tall cakes in like a six inch round pan and then slicing them very finely, getting anywhere from like 4 to 6 layers out of one baked cake. To be able to do that, your cake has to have a certain kind of consistency. So in those cakes where I'm aiming to make those really fine sort of base layers, it's all butter. I make sure the cake is super cold when I cut it. It can't be too squishy. It can't have too much egg in it, or it'll sort of start to tear in ways that won't lend itself to being able to be stacked nicely later and to being like neat and clean. But then there are those layers that have to be super flexible because they're making like, you know, that kind of V shape inside the cake. I need to basically be able to fold the cake into a cone.
If you're listening to this and thinking like, you have to what? You have to watch this, because you're not using a mold. You've essentially cut the shape.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I took some inspiration from paper craft just because of, you know, understanding how to cut a circle and fold it over onto itself to make that cone shape came from that. That cake has to be ultra flexible. And so I actually use a different recipe. And it's based on a very sort of flexible sponge cake recipe with like tons of eggs, because there it just needs to be able to bend without breaking. And usually that cake, I need to work with it when it's more at room temperature, because it can't be too stiff. And it's got to be oil-based instead of butter-based, because that'll give it additional flexibility. So a lot of it is also just like nerdiness. I read cookbooks. I own over 400 cookbooks. I'm obsessed with them. I picked up a lot of technique, a lot of theory, a lot of, you know, this and that from reading. A bunch of my collection is like random culinary school, you know, instructional books and stuff like that. I love the science and I love tinkering with recipes and that kind of thing. So really at the end of the day, it's all about those recipes.
I noticed on your blog, Zara, that you refer to yourself as a nerd quite often.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I'm a huge nerd. I read a ton and love to learn. And anything I do, I kind of dive as far into it as I possibly can. And I was actually considering a career in the academic world and decided against that at a certain point when I felt like I started to feel like I was speaking a different language from other people around me. And that when I was working on these theses and stuff where I was using all this theoretical language, it was only for a very small audience. And that felt really lame. I wanted to be able to have whatever my career was be something that was more open and where I could touch more people and have conversations with more people.
What were you thinking of pursuing?
Anthropology. So the study of human culture, specifically food anthropology. So in undergrad, I spent my junior year abroad living in India, in South India. And part of that was so that I could do Bharatanatyam, which is a classical South Indian dance form, and Carnatic music, which is like classical South Indian music. But I also did this pretty extensive anthropology project where I was looking at sweets in South India and the sort of like politics around how sweets get used, which actually turned out to be really fascinating and complicated. Yeah, and I really loved that experience. I loved going out and talking to women in their kitchens about what they were making and why, and going out to sweet shops and talking to the folks who were running those and making the sweets there and trying to understand, you know, what was going on there. And so, yeah, so I thought there was a good chance. Both of my parents are academics, so I thought there was a good chance I was going to head in that direction. But then I basically decided that, yeah, it wasn't, that wasn't the right choice for me. I needed to be more hands-on.
Wow, but how fascinating. I mean, what an interesting project that you worked on.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I love traveling in general and meeting people and stuff. So yeah, I was very lucky to be able to do that.
Well, academia's loss is our gain. I want to go back to just the making of some of these cakes because I'm still just so blown away by it. There's really an element of fearlessness in making them because they are, you might not think of them as that complicated, but to the rest of us, they're incredibly complicated. How do you even approach one of these cakes? Because there's so much room for error.
So I'm a pretty serious planner. I love strategy. And so basically what I do is I sit down and I build a schematic. I start out by generally brainstorming what I'm trying to accomplish. And then I will draw almost sort of like a blueprint of what I want the inside of the cake to look like. And then from there, I can basically build out an idea of how I'm going to make that work. The most challenging part is thinking three-dimensionally, because when I'm looking at it, the two-dimensional image that I want to get when I cut through, you know, into the cake and expose the inside, I have to be careful because basically you have to think about that image then becoming three-dimensional in a way that any way you cut the cake, that image is going to show up in the middle. What I mean by that is when I'm trying to make like a V shape on the inside of a cake, that's why I'm taking that round of cake and I'm folding it into a cone. Because when you cut a cone in half, then what you're looking at on the surface is a V shape. And so it's kind of like reverse engineering that process, starting with like the two-dimensional shape that I'd like to get. It took me a little while to kind of wrap my head around it, but once I got the hang of it, it's pretty easy for me to do now. Yeah, at the end of the day, it's really just about making sure that I'm confident in, you know, in the schematics that I've drawn up. And I'm going to be honest with you, it's not very often that I cut into a cake and it doesn't look pretty much like what I had intended. I'm pretty meticulous about it.
I'm happy to hear that. Another thing that surprised me is I thought you would have tons of tools to make these cakes. And when you watch your videos, it's pretty surprising how few tools you use to make these. Can you walk us through what your essentials are?
Big essentials when I'm building a cake are going to be, like, I have this one bread knife, a serrated bread knife that I've had for forever where the handle is falling off and stuff, but it's my absolute favorite. So a good sharp bread knife for cutting those thin layers really cleanly. And then I use, you know, like a miniature palette knife or like icing spatula to, you know, put down most of my buttercream just because my cakes are all 6 inches around. They're pretty small and I don't need anything bigger than that usually. And then, yeah, as we get into the more sort of fancy stuff, I use a paring knife, super sharp paring knife for cutting any pieces of cake out. Yeah, mostly just that. And then if I'm, you know, folding a piece of sponge cake into a cone, I'll usually use scissors over a knife just because it's cleaner to cut into the circle so that I can fold it over.
I saw that. I was like, oh, wow, she's cutting a cake layer with a pair of scissors.
Yeah, it's just the most convenient thing. I use scissors in the kitchen constantly, though, constantly. And I'm actually surprised that we don't do it more often because it's so much easier and a lot of times more efficient than cutting something with a knife against, you know, a cutting board or something like that. I love using scissors.
I'm going to have to get your brand recommendations later so we can share with everybody because I'm always on the hunt for a good pair of kitchen scissors or shears.
Oh, sure. And I'm going to be real with you. I usually just use like, you know, regular, like
anything.
Just random scissors that I also use for cutting paper. I'll just like wash them first. Yeah, I'm really low tech over here.
I also, because your cakes are so vertical, thought that you would have some kind of stand that you put them in, but you don't.
No, they're freestanding. You know, a lot of that is about temperature, making sure that the cakes stay cold while I'm cutting them, which is interesting because it's, you know, you don't necessarily want to eat cake cold. You want it to come to room temperature. For the sake of keeping everything very clean, I like to cut the cakes cold. The other part of it too is that the buttercream that I use is meringue-based buttercream. I use Italian meringue buttercream, although Swiss meringue buttercream would work really well too.
Can you tell everyone the difference? I'm pretty basic. I am an American buttercream man. So tell everyone the difference between those two.
Italian meringue buttercream is made when you boil a sugar syrup and use that to sort of slowly pour into egg whites that you're beating to create a very stable meringue. And then you're beating butter into that meringue once it cools down. Swiss meringue buttercream, rather than boiling a sugar syrup, you are using a double boiler to basically melt sugar into your egg whites at a very low temperature. And then, you know, once the sugar is dissolved into the egg whites, you use that to create a meringue. And then you're beating butter into that. And so it's, you know, they're very similar. But in my experience, I've found that Italian meringue buttercream winds up being a little bit like fluffier because I feel like the meringue that's made with a boiled sugar syrup ends up being a little bit more stable. So when you are beating the butter into it, it ends up maintaining more of that like fluffy air bubbles. And that's just been in my experience. And with both of those, when you refrigerate them or freeze them, but I usually just refrigerate, they become like rock hard. They're really, really, really hard. And so not super pleasant to eat, but a lot easier to do things like trim them down so that you can get super, super sharp edges on your cakes, which I'm a really big fan of.
That's another amazing part of your videos where you slice, again, with this your trademark fearlessness, you know, you slice the outside of the layers, the frosting and the cake. And it's just beautiful because you reveal these incredible colors. Walk us through that process when you, I guess you're sort of shaving the outside of the cake essentially.
Yeah, I trim my cakes just because I like to have that really clean look on the inside. It's, you know, not necessary. Not everybody does it, but I don't like to have that caramelization, that coloring on the outside because there's so much focus on what the inside of the cake looks like for me. And you can do that a couple of ways. I've worked at a cake shop where we trimmed the cake before we layered it with buttercream. I prefer to layer everything up and then trim it all at the same time, just because for me, that creates the absolute cleanest possible line when you finally cut the cake, because you've just trimmed it all together and it's all super perfect. Yeah. And I love that part. It's so fun. And it's one of those kind of unexpectedly fun things where you wouldn't necessarily think about it, you know, and I wasn't recording that part of the process for a long time. I was just like enjoying it on my own, being like, this is so cool. But eventually I was like, oh, wait, this is actually a really fun moment to kind of start to reveal the colors on the inside and to see all those cool layers.
Well, on behalf of your fans, thank you for sharing. I do love that part. What do you use to cut them?
Just that exact same bread knife.
The same knife. Exactly. Like I said, you don't have a lot of tools. How about for the frosting of the cake? What do you use for that?
Yeah, so it sort of depends on what I'm trying to accomplish. You know, I don't really use fondant or anything. I have professional experience with it, but in my own practice, I like to stick with buttercream or ganache if I'm feeling like it. But usually I will use a piping bag that I've just sort of clipped the top off of. I don't really use a circular tip or anything because there's no point. And I fill that with buttercream. And then I sort of spin the cake as I pipe buttercream onto the sides and sort of slowly build up, you know, up the side of the cake essentially. And what this does is it just, for me, because the cakes are so tall, it's more efficient to pipe the buttercream up the side like that and then use a big cake scraper to smooth the buttercream down than it would be if I was, say, using a larger palette knife, you know, scooping the buttercream onto the sides and then like smoothing it as I went with the knife. That's easier to do on a shorter cake, but on a bigger cake, it really starts to hurt your arm and you kind of have to twist all different ways to like make it work. The piping technique just is a lot easier for me. Usually that's if I want a solid base, like a single color base or something like that. If I'm trying to do a fault line look, you know, I will still come in with that piping bag, but be a little bit more careful when I'm scraping, maybe use different colors, which is super fun. There's all kinds of different stuff you can do.
And then for decorating the outside, because you do all different things. I mean, you've done basket weave, you've done a cactus, you do flowers, you do that, you did that amazing one. I'm not quite sure what the technique is called. It's almost like dots.
Pontilism. It's the exact same as like the art term is how I've seen people referring to it. Yeah, that one was crazy. That took forever and my hand was killing me by the end of it.
Oh my gosh. What are your tools for those techniques?
Mostly, piping tips, different piping tips. You know, with the flowers, just like the classic rose piping tip and carnation piping tip. For the pontilism, like a really, really tiny round and just piping tiny dots over and over again. I worked on a cake recently for food.com, which is this sort of food entity that I develop recipes for sometimes. And then I'll do like cake decorating tutorials and stuff through them sometimes. And I use tweezers to place sprinkles in a very specific pattern. Anything that's kind of meticulous or overly fussy, I'm a really big fan of, generally speaking.
That's crazy. I need to see a picture of that cake. Azara, you mentioned the fault line cakes. Mm-hmm. Now, I think I was talking to Nikki Pensabene, who some of our listeners might know. She's by Pensa on Instagram. We love Nikki.
She's so great.
I think I asked her who came up with the idea for fault line cakes, and she said it was you. Mm-hmm. We're talking to the inventor of fault line cake.
Basically, a while ago, actually right when I was just starting my Instagram, I was working on a cake and I got partway through, you know, that whole process I was talking about where I'm piping buttercream up the side of the cake. And I realized that I didn't have enough buttercream to fully coat the entire cake. And so I kind of had this moment of being like, okay, I don't have time to make more buttercream. How can I work with this? Like, what do I do? And I decided to leave a gap, because I really, really love the way the layers look. And I was kind of like, you know what, why can't, you know, that sort of fine layering be part of the decoration? Because it's kind of a cool thing of like peering into the cake. And I had done naked cakes before. And I really, you know, I liked that look, but I thought this sort of kind of like peekaboo sort of thing would be kind of fun. You know, I did the cake that way. I left this kind of organic gap right in the middle of the cake. And I scraped it down and found that the gap kind of stayed exactly how I had piped it. And I put it up there and I really liked it. And so I did a couple of other cakes like that too. And at that point, I didn't have a lot of followers. I wasn't making any kind of an impact in the cake world. But at the same time, word may have gotten out, because I think the people who were following me were pretty much exclusively cake decorators at that time, other cake folk. You know, when we in the cake world see something new and fun, you know, we like definitely want to explore it and mess around with it. And so I started seeing other people doing it too. And it was really cool to kind of look out there and be like, wow, like this is actually, you know, looks like it's starting to become a thing. And then at a certain point, people started coming to me and being like, you know, we've been doing some research, we've been poking around, we think you started this trend. And I was kind of like, I think I might have started the trend. I don't know that I popularized it. You know, I think there are much larger platforms that did tutorials that kind of made it what it is at this point, in terms of being kind of like a standard part of the cake decorating repertoire. But I think I might have started it. So,
Azara, I'm so blown away, because so many times with cake trends, or just really any food trend, you're always like, where did this start and who's really responsible for it? So I don't know. I think it's super exciting that you started this. Who named it fault line?
I don't know. I didn't.
Wow. I guess it looks like a fault line.
Yeah. It was a really cool idea. I was like, that's awesome. I'm definitely using that.
You must be amazed how it's taken off.
Yeah, I you know, I am. And I think that of all of the, you know, the kind of new things that I've started doing with cake, it's definitely the most approachable. It's the most sort of achievable, just with whatever kind of buttercream you're using. It doesn't have to be anything specific. The technique is like, once you kind of get the hang of it, like very straightforward. So I think that's probably why, of everything that I've, you know, started messing around with, that one is the one that sort of took hold. It's also closer to traditional cake decorating. Like, you know, it's working on the outside of the cake. And, you know, granted, for me, it came out of like kind of laziness and kind of being like, I don't have time to make more buttercream, and just sort of throwing something together. But it, you know, it ended up giving people sort of something to work with when they wanted to. Like, there are people who, you know, have these exposed sections of their cake that are filled with like macarons and you know, like painted images and stuff like that. And it's super cool. So yeah, very versatile and very approachable.
Well, people have taken the fault line concept and run with it. And now you've got the fault line, but they fill, you know, the space that you would leave open with, you know, roses and the geode cake. I feel like the geode cake maybe even evolved from the fault line cake.
Oh, well, the geode cake actually existed before the fault line
cake. It did.
And the reason why is because I know the person who invented the geode cake.
Who invented the geode cake?
Rachel Tufel. She does intricate icings in Colorado. And she was an instructor with Craftsy when I was an acquisitions editor there. And Craftsy was based in Denver. And so she was one of our like awesome kind of go-to instructors and like super wonderful. And she developed the geode cake. And eventually she taught a class with us on that geode cake.
I love figuring out where all the trends started. I'd love to know who was the first to do the naked cake.
I think you're going to have to go back in history for that one. I think that's something that people have probably been doing for a long time, but just sort of became popular for some reason at some point. I will say, obviously, Christina Tosi kind of took it to the next level where she was a huge inspiration for me, by the way, in terms of embracing the layers of a cake and really getting excited about what that looks like. And I would even say that she inspired me to feel confident about putting that first fault line cake up because of that very sort of organic. I mean, her cakes look like you took a core of the earth, you know, and you pulled it out and you're like looking at the different layers of like sediment and rock and stuff. And I think that's so, so cool. And so that kind of really organic approach was something that, you know, definitely played a role in me feeling, you know, good about posting that first fault line cake.
Oh, that's so cool. We love Christina. And obviously you've had cakes that have not been iced for years and decades and centuries. But the idea of celebrating the layers, mm-hmm. the way the naked cakes did, I feel like that was definitely a modern technique of
definitely. Sort. Yeah, definitely a reflection of that embrace of the organic, you know, as a sort of moving away from ultra fondanted, you know, ultra kind of symmetrical cakes that were in vogue, you know, in like the 80s, 90s. And then you really get into some stuff that starts to loosen up a little bit as you move into the 2000s. And it's really cool to see how the trends in the cake world are also reflections of the broader design world, you know, and they're all so deeply interconnected. So anything that you see trending as far as even fashion and web design, like all kinds of stuff, you'll see that reflected in how cake design develops.
So this begs one of the questions that I was planning on asking you later, but how the hell do you not have a book?
I don't know. I guess part of it is that I always have a full-time job at any given time. So my Milk Moon Cake stuff is always on the side. And so because I am not super consistent with it, because I've never really had the time to be, I think, you know, as far as platform development and all that sort of stuff, you know, it's just slow going for me. And any of the kind of growth in audience that I've seen and that sort of thing has oftentimes just been kind of lucky as opposed to any real sort of regular concerted effort on my part, which is obviously, you know, something that I would love to change at some point, but, you know, not exactly sure when that's going to happen. A lot of the times I'm just flying under the radar, especially for book publishers. A lot of times what you're doing when you're looking for someone to write a book with you is either you're looking for someone who has a ton of connections, you know, in the cake world, and there's a lot of networking that goes on and you find them that way, or you're looking at the size of their platform and thinking about what their audience might be like. And none of those are really part of my reality so far.
When it comes to your obvious skill and your knowledge, and I mean, just all this cake anthropology you're rattling off for all of us, I see a lifetime of books in your future.
That would be awesome. I mean, I'm obsessed with cookbooks, right? Like I read them like you would read a novella. So I feel like I'd probably be really good at it, hopefully at some point.
Well, if any agents are listening or any book books, you all need to DM Azara.
I'm here. I'm waiting.
Okay. A few more cake technique questions. The amazing colors that you get.
Yeah.
How do you achieve those?
I use Americolor. Gel colors fairly liberally. Yeah. And then I just have worked pretty hard to tweak my cake bases to the point where the ones that I use the most often to add color to are fairly white. When I add the coloring to them, it's fairly true, as opposed to a cake that might be a little more yellow and would kind of mess with the color that was being added to it. But it's pretty much exclusively Americolor gel paste that I use. I'm definitely interested in exploring the world of natural dyes that you make yourself, just because, again, with anything, you know, kind of extra fussy or finicky, I get really excited about it. So the idea of like making my own dyes seems really cool to me. Also time consuming, obviously. I think there are now more and more powders and things that you can use that create brighter natural colors than you would have been able to otherwise. At the same time, I'm just so attracted to those bold colors that I don't foresee giving up gel colors anytime soon. And, you know, I definitely understand the argument. I've had people comment on my Instagram and that sort of thing, being like, these are dangerous, you shouldn't feed them to children and that sort of thing. And generally speaking, my cakes aren't being fed to children anyways. They usually would go to my husband's job. and so everybody there could have some. But at the same time, I do understand that feeling of like, you don't want to be putting too much of these bright colorings in your body because it's, you know, it's chemicals. At the same time, I feel like, you know, a little bit of anything is totally fine and they're food safe and they're fun. Yeah, I really don't have that much of a problem with it.
You're not recommending these for your three daily meals?
I wouldn't recommend cake in general for for your three daily meals. I've done it. It hasn't worked out super great.
So tell us about some of the cakes you're proudest of.
So I made a cake a while ago that was a Rick and Morty themed cake with one of the characters on top. And when you sliced into the middle of the cake, so Rick and Morty, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a cartoon. I love cartoons. Probably part of my obsession with bright colors, now that I think about it, comes from how obsessed I am with cartoons. It's a very kind of like cerebral sci-fi cartoon that has made a really big splash in the past few years. And one of the things is the characters will create these sort of portals, these green sort of glowy portals, to travel through. And I decided to make an interdimensional portal cake. So when you cut into the middle of it, it has like that green glowy portal on the inside. And it came out like really well. Like it was one of those things where I was just like, oh my gosh, this is like exactly what I had pictured. When I sort of think about it compared to some of my other cakes, the execution was relatively simple. This was a while ago when I was just kind of starting to figure stuff out. But it was just so much like what I wanted it to be that I was really excited about that. More recently, that Pontilism cake that you were mentioning before, I built a lit candle into the inside of it. Not an actual lit candle, but like the image of a lit candle. Oh, that's something I should work on, though. That sounds really exciting. I did that one to thank all of the first responders and everyone working in healthcare who were responding to the COVID crisis. And so I was really proud of that one, both from a sort of like emotional and like philosophical standpoint, but then also execution wise, it was really difficult to put that cake together. And I thought I pulled it off really well and was very, very proud of that. And both on the inside and the outside, which is a new thing for me, because generally speaking, on the outside of the cake, I'm pretty, you know, since I've taken all the time to build the cake together on the outside, I'm sort of like, okay, I don't really have time to do anything too intricate. And for this one, I really wanted to go all out and make sure that, you know, that it was really a proper thank you.
What percentage of the cakes on your Instagram are commissions versus just things you do for yourself?
Very few are commissions. I do some tutorials and stuff for food.com and Food Network, but those are, you know, not super frequent. And for the most part, I'm just making stuff for myself.
My next birthday, anyone who's listening, I want a Milk Moon cake. You also made us this gorgeous cherry bomb cake.
Yeah.
Again, I think that was one you just did, you know, for kicks and for yourself and to celebrate, you know, our Jubilee conference, which is really sweet. But you did it because you couldn't go to Jubilee that year.
Yeah, yeah. I did not plan very well. And I ended up not being able to get a ticket. But the next year, I saved up and I was able to come.
Hopefully, Azara, you will be involved in a future Jubilee when we get to actually have gatherings again.
That would be so fun.
I know. I'm really sad about the whole state of of events. And I know you are too, because it's impacted your income. You were doing cakes professionally for a bakery.
Yes. Yes, I was. I was at Nine Cakes in Brooklyn.
Oh, I love Nine Cakes.
I know. It was amazing. It was like the coolest job ever. I came in to replace Rose McAdoo, who was doing all the baking for Nine Cakes before she basically picked everything up and moved to Antarctica to live at the McMurdo research base out there. She's amazing. Her handle is Whisk Me Away Cakes. Basically, she is baking out in Antarctica. It's incredibly cool. And a lot of her focus is on spreading awareness about the projects that are going on up there and the environmental stuff that's going on. And she's basically just kind of, she's been diving fully into all the science that she has access to there. There are lectures that happen all the time, and she's been going to those and just really getting interested in life in extreme temperatures and geological surveys and stuff like that. It's incredibly cool. And so she, you know, left to go and be amazing, you know, at the ends of the earth. And she and I had met recently at a foodie gathering kind of thing. Yeah, and she reached out to me just being like, hey, I'm leaving this job and I think that you would actually probably really like it. And I had a desk job at the time, which is most of my work experience is doing desk jobs. And I was kind of like, you know what, like, I'm gonna go for it. It was really amazing. Betsy Thorlifson is the owner of Nine Cakes, and she was like the most incredible boss on the planet. All my coworkers there were and are, continue to be so super amazing. We're all still in very close contact. And it was really great. And then, you know, COVID happened and the wedding industry completely fell apart in New York City. You know, we ended up getting laid off as basically every single wedding cake order that we had dried up for the whole rest of the year. It happened in the matter of a few days. It was pretty unbelievable.
Wow. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. I mean, we had Marcy Bloom on the show a few weeks ago, and she's a major wedding planner and party planner. And just knowing what all our friends in the event business are going through and the ripple effect, I think that's what people forget. You know, the AV people, the folks you rent everything from, the catering companies who work behind the scenes, the bakers,
the florists,
I'm just praying, and I know a lot of you are too, that things can return to normal and all the talents we love out there and all the companies and all the people who, you know, work so hard can have their livelihoods restored soon. We didn't talk about the cherry bomb cake. So you did this gorgeous cake for us, inspired by cherry bomb, thank you, but also inspired by Spumoni.
Yeah, Spumoni is one of my all-time favorite ice cream flavors. I grew up in Berkeley in California, and on, you know, sort of special weekends, my family would go out to San Francisco and go to Little Italy and have these like really awesome Italian meals. And at the end, oftentimes one of the desserts that they offered was Spumoni, and, you know, it's got candied fruit in it and stuff. And so I think probably not, you know, a go-to choice for a lot of little kids. It's also got pistachio ice cream. It's like usually pistachio, chocolate, and then like a candied cherry kind of ice cream. Although I've seen, you know, other sort of manifestations of it. But I was really into it as a kid and I super loved it. And it's a very kind of nostalgic flavor for me. And so when I was thinking about what I would want to do for Cherry Bomb, I obviously wanted to center cherries as, you know, a part of the flavor profile. But I decided to go with Spumoni just because I think I was playing with the idea of kind of like 1950s domesticity sort of thing, but flipping it on its head by going way, you know, above and beyond and out of control with, you know, what the cake ended up looking like. And, you know, kind of using that like 1950s palette too of the pistachio green and the sort of soft cherry to create something that was kind of like felt retro, but also very modern and contemporary and sort of forward thinking. And I always think about those two sides of the coin when you think about women in the culinary space and where we've been and how far we've come and that sort of freedom of expression that so many of us are embracing these days.
Well, I would have loved to have had that cake at Jubilee and sliced it up for everyone. And that leads to my next question. How the heck do you box up and transport these cakes?
the only times I've been transporting some of these really tall cakes have been if I'm making, you know, like a wedding cake for my friend or something like that. Generally speaking, I'll just get them very, very, very cold, like frozen, basically. I'll build special boxes for them just by cutting different boxes and sort of piecing them together. And then, you know, it's just about like slow, careful driving. I will say it's less scary to me to get one of those sort of tall single-tiered cakes to a venue than it is to think about transporting like a giant multi-tiered cake that has structuring on the inside. That, I mean, it's just like the scariest thing ever. And when I was at Nine Cakes, you know, that's something that we did all the time. And every time one of those huge, like 6 to 7 tier giant cakes went out, I would just be absolutely terrified. So for me, those like the smaller, even if they're tall, the smaller ones, because they're pretty stable, you know, it's like on a nice stable base and everything, it's a lot less scary.
It's amazing. All right. So you recently became a new mom.
Yes, I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
Doing well. Yeah, it's a lot. You know, you go into it with everyone telling you it's going to be a lot. And, you know, obviously you can't possibly know how much of a lot it'll be until you're there. But it's also been just so amazing. My little boy, his name is Jacob King Cravaton. And he's just a total little sweetie. And, you know, we're doing all kinds of fun stuff right now where he's 9 weeks today. So he is starting to smile a lot. He's starting to coo and giggle. And, you know, he's just amazing. He's a little like delightful little guy.
He sounds like a little angel. So that means you were pregnant through a lot of COVID.
Yep. The whole thing.
That must have been so challenging.
It was. It definitely gave me a lot to think about in terms of bringing a baby into a world that's going through a number of very challenging things. You know, I gave birth in a mask. It was a very bizarre experience, very different from what I was expecting. I had done all this planning to have like a doula and a midwife and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And then we found out that only my husband was going to be allowed to come into the hospital with me. And so it really changed a lot very quickly about what my expectations were for what this was going to look like. You know, at the same time, everything worked out, you know, and even having lost, both my husband and I lost our jobs at the beginning of COVID, and he found another one pretty quickly afterwards, which was really great. And, you know, very grateful for that. But, you know, so we ended up, you know, doing okay. In the end, it was scary though. It's definitely a scary experience.
Well, I'm really grateful that you're doing okay. And to all the new moms and new parents out there, I just wish everybody the best, because I can't imagine just how, you know, challenging and terrifying, but beautiful at the same time it is to, you know, have a new baby right now.
Yeah. No matter what, the beauty of having this child is still very much the same. And in fact, I think even more so in certain ways, because he really represented, a light, you know, through a dark time, for us and for the country, for our families, you know. He was just this constant little source of joy for us, throughout a lot of really challenging stuff.
Absolutely. Azara, you mentioned, you know, bringing a child into a world that's going through a lot right now, you know, and I noticed on your Instagram on June 3rd, you know, you posted a black square, as a lot of people did on your Instagram feed, but you talked about the racism that you and your family have been subjected to. So I was curious, you know, what kind of change would you like to see in the industry? You know, both the industry that you're directly in, cakes and you know, Instagram and bakeries and all of that, but also the food industry at large.
Yeah, well, I think in the cake world specifically, there are some really, really incredible Black decorators out there. And when I was working at Craftsy, I got pretty frustrated because it was, you know, as I was acquiring new instructors, it got really difficult to basically convince, you know, the folks that I was working for to bring a lot of like instructors of color and Black instructors on, just because they didn't have the same kind of exposure that we were seeing with with white instructors. And, you know, there are so many reasons for that. It's all extremely complicated and extremely frustrating. But I am glad that right now there is this kind of conversation happening about giving people more of a platform and giving Black voices more of a platform. Just more broadly in the food industry, I think the same thing. But I'm glad to see that there are efforts being made right now and that, you know, there's a kind of seriousness that a lot of these conversations are being had with at this point that I have never seen before. So I feel like that's very encouraging. And it's something that I'm very excited about. So I think the future is looking brighter, despite the fact that right now there's just so much turmoil and conflict.
Azara, we know how busy you are, and I'm going to let you go. I honestly could talk to you for another hour. You are so fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
And I really, like I said, I really hope there are books in your future, and please make more videos. I know you have a newborn baby at home. You're such a talent, and I just hope the future is super, super bright for you. If people would like to work with you, what's the best way to get in touch?
DM me through Instagram, at Milk Moon Kitchen. Yeah, if you'd like to collaborate, if you'd like to talk about a project or anything like that, I'm here. It'll be a little crazy for a little while with my little boy, you know, but I'm always open to starting a conversation. So please do get in touch.
Terrific. Well, Azara, you are such a talent and such a treasure, and I'm really honored you're part of the Bomb Squad.
Thank you so much, Carrie. This has been such an honor. So cool. Thank you very much.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Azara for sitting down with us and sharing her story. Be sure to check out her beautiful and very unique cakes at Milk Moon Kitchen on Instagram. Thanks to Kerrygold for supporting today's show and making the butter and cheese we all love so much. Radio Cherry Bomb is edited by Kat Gorelli. Our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra La La. Radio Cherry Bomb is produced by Cherry Bomb Media. Hang in there, everybody, and thank you for listening. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hi, my name is Christina Wong, and I'm the co-founder, creator, and chief chicken wrangler at Baking with Chickens, my weirdly wonderful world where I bake using eggs from my backyard chickens here in Los Angeles. You know who I think is the bomb? Jolene Rivera, the founder and creative director of Kitchen Toke, a magazine that elevates the use of culinary cannabis for health and wellness. Jolene is so bomb that she created the world's only full-spectrum, whole-plant hemp honey that's made naturally by bees and not mixed by humans.